at least some sense of being in a hospital for a few nights? Of breathing with a ventilator? Or of fighting the doctor? I mean, look at what it says, Eric. I had to be sedated. She gets up suddenly and walks out of the closet, asking the administrative assistant where the pediatric ICU ward is. Determined, she gets into the elevator and heads upstairs. It looks different, surely, than it used to. There are bright murals of aquariums and Disney princesses on the walls and rainbows painted on the windows. Children, tethered to IV poles, navigate the halls with their parents. Babies cry behind closed doors. A candy striper gets off another elevator and pushes past us, her face hidden by a bouquet of balloons. She brings them into the room opposite us. The patient is a little girl. "Can we tie them to the bed?" she asks, "and see if I float?" "I didn't have balloons," Delia murmurs. "They weren't allowed in the ICU." She crosses in front of me, but she might as well be 1,000 miles away. "He brought me candy instead. A lollipop shaped like a scorpion. He told me to bite it back." "Your dad?" "I don't think so. This is crazy, but it was someone who looked like Victor. The guy my mother's married to now." She shakes her head, bewildered. "He told me not to tell anyone he came to visit." I scuff my shoe on the linoleum. "Huh," I say. "If I got bitten in 1976, my parents were still married." Delia looks up at me. What if my mother was having an affair, Eric?" I don't answer. "Eric," Delia says, "did you hear me?" She was. "What?" "Your father told me." "And you didn't tell me?" "I couldn't tell you, Delia." "What else are you holding back?" 100 answers run through my mind, from details of conversations I've had with Andrew in jail to the deposition I took from Delia's former nursery school teacher. Things that she's better off not hearing, although she would never believe me if I told her so. "You're the one who wanted me to represent your father," I argue. "If I tell you the things he tells me, I get tossed off the case or disbarred. So you pick, Delia. Do you want me to put you first or him?" Too late, I realize I never should have asked that question. She shoves past me without saying a word and strides down the hallway. "Delia, wait," I say, as she steps into the elevator. I put my hand between the doors to keep it from closing. "Stop. I promise. I'll tell you everything I know." The last thing I see before the doors close are her eyes, the soft, bruised brown of disappointment. "Why start now?" she says. The taxi drops me off at Hamilton, but instead of going into the office building, I take a left and start walking the streets of Phoenix. I walk far enough that the Tony's stucco storefronts disappear, and I find myself in places where kids in low-riding pants hang out on the corner, watching traffic without flicking their yellow eyes. I pass a boarded-up drugstore, a wig shop, and a kiosk that reads "Checks Cashed" in multiple languages. Delia is right. If I managed to figure out a way to keep her from knowing what her father told me, surely I would have been able to figure out a way to keep the Bar Association from knowing what I might have told her. It doesn't matter that, in terms of legal ethics, I shouldn't have disclosed to her any information about her father's case or her own absent history. It doesn't matter that I promise as much to Judge Noble and to Chris Hamilton, my sponsor in this state. The bottom line is that ethics are a lofty standard, but affection ranks higher. What is the point of being an exemplary attorney in the long run? You never see that on anyone's tombstone. You see who loved them. You see who they loved back. I duck into the next store and let the air conditioning wash over me. There is the unmistakable, yeasty smell of cardboard cartons, the ching of a cash register. One wall is covered with the emerald green bottles of foreign wines. The entire back shelf is a transparent panorama of gins and vodka and vermouth. The full-bellied brandies sit side by side like Buddhas. I head to the corner of whiskeys. The cashier puts the maker's mark into a brown bag for me and hands me back my change. When I leave the store, I twist off the cap of the whiskey bottle. I lift the bottle to my lips and tilt back my head and savor that first, blessed, anesthetic mouthful. And like I expect, that's all I need for the fog in my head to clear, leaving one honest admission. Even if I had been free to tell Delia anything and everything, I still wouldn't have done it. As Andrew has been trying to explain for weeks, it was easier to hide the truth than to hurt her. So does that make me guilty? Or admirable? What is right in the end is not always what it seems to be, and some rules are better broken. But what about when those rules happen to be laws? Tipping the whiskey bottle, I spill the entire contents down a sewer grate. It's a long shot, but I think I've just found a way out for Andrew Hopkins.
This ends Disc 9. Vanishing Acts, Disc 10.
Delia. By the time I reach my mother's house, my emotions are hanging by a thread. I've been lied to by Fitz and by Eric. I've been lied to by my father. And I have come here because, ironically, my mother is my last resort. I need someone to tell me the things I want to hear. That she loved my father. That I have jumped to the wrong conclusion. That the truth is not always what you think it is. When my mother doesn't answer the doorbell, I let myself into her unlocked house. I follow her voice down a hallway. "How does that feel?" she asks. "Much better," a man answers. I peer through a doorway to find my mother gently tying a knot in a silk cord around a younger man's neck. Seeing me, he startles, nearly falling off his stool. "Delia," she says. The man's face turns bright red. He seems incredibly embarrassed to have been caught, even fully clothed, with my mother. "Stay," she says. "Henry and I are finishing up." He digs in his pants for his wallet. "Gracias, Doña Elise," he mutters, shoving a $10 bill into her hands. "He's paying her?" "You have to keep wearing your red socks and your red underwear for me, understand?" "Yes, ma'am," he replies, and he backs out of the room in a hurry. I stare at her, speechless for a moment. "Does Victor know?" "I try to keep it a secret," my mother blushes. "To be honest, I wasn't sure how you'd react either." Her eyes suddenly brighten. "If you're interested, though, I'd love to teach you." It is then that I notice the rows of jars behind her, filled with leaves and roots and buds and soil, and I realize we are talking about very different things. "What is all this?" "It's part of the business," she says. "I'm a curandera, a healer, sort of a doctor for the people doctors can't help. Henry, for example, has been here 3 times already. You're not sleeping with him?" She looks at me as if I'm crazy. "Henry? Of course not. He's been hospitalized 2 times because his throat keeps swelling shut, but no medical professional can find anything wrong with him. The minute he walked in here, I knew it was one of his neighbors hexing him, and I'm working with him to break the spell. My own business involves things that cannot be seen, but it's rooted in the basics of science. Human cells attacked by bacteria which create vapor trails. Once again, I look at this woman and think she is an utter stranger. Do you honestly believe that? What I believe doesn't matter. It's what he believes. People come to me because they get to help with their cure. The client knots the special cord, or buries the sealed matchbox, or rubs the candle. Who doesn't want to have a hand in controlling their own future? It was what I had thought I wanted, but now that I am starting to remember, I am not so sure. I touch my hand to the scar at my throat, the discovery that brought me here. If you're a healer, why couldn't you save me? Her eyes fall to the small hollow. Because back then, she admits, I couldn't even save myself. Suddenly, this is all too hard. I'm tired of putting up walls. I want someone with the strength and the honesty to break them down. Then do it now, I demand. Pretend I'm some client. There's nothing wrong with you. Yes, there is, I say. I hurt. I hurt all the time. Tears pierce the back of my throat. You've got to have some magic that makes things disappear. Some potion or spell or cord I can tie around my wrist that'll make me forget how you drank and how you cheated on my father. She steps back as if she's been slapped. What could you give me? I ask, my voice shaking, to make me forget that you forgot about me. My mother hesitates for a moment and then walks stiffly to her shelves. She pulls down three containers and a glass mixing bowl. She opens the seals. I smell nutmeg, summertime, a distillation of hope. But she does not mix me a poultice or make a roux for me to swallow. She doesn't wrap my wrists with green silk or tell me to blow out three squat candles. Instead, she comes hesitantly around her workbench. She folds me into her arms, even as I try to break free. She refuses to let go the whole time that I cry. It seems as if we have been driving forever. Ruthann and I take turns during the night while Sophie and Greta sleep in the back seat. We head north on Interstate 17, passing places with names like Bloody Basin Road and Horse Thief Basin, Jackass Acres, Little Squaw Creek. We pass the skeletons of saguaros inside which birds have made their homes and the smashed amber glass from beer bottles which line the side of the road like glitter. Gradually, the cacti vanish and deciduous trees begin to pepper the foothills. The altitude makes the temperature drop to a point where the air is so cool I have to roll up the window. Walls of striated red rock rise in the distance, set on fire by the rising sun. I'm not running away. Not really. I just sort of invited myself to accompany Ruthann on a trip to visit her family on Second Mesa. She wasn't too keen on the idea, but I pulled out all the stops. I told her that I thought it was important for Sophie to learn more about the world. I told her that I wanted to see more in Arizona than the jail system. I told her that I needed to talk to someone, and that I wanted it to be her. As we drive, I tell Ruthann about Fitz's story for the Gazette. I tell her about the scorpion sting and what I remembered about Victor and what Eric already knew. I don't tell her about my mother. Right now, I want to keep that moment to myself, a silver dollar tucked into the hem of my mind to take out in an emergency. So you really begged me to come to Second Mesa because you're angry at Eric, Ruthann says. I didn't beg, I say, and she just raises a brow. Well, maybe just a little. Ruthann is quiet for a few seconds. Let's say Eric had told you that your mother had been having an affair when he first found out. Would it have kept your parents from splitting up? No. Would it have kept your father from running away with you? No. Would it have meant that your father wouldn't have been arrested? Nope. Far as I can tell, the only purpose served by telling you would be to get you even more upset, kind of like you are now. Eric knows how hard this is for me, I say. It's like doing a jigsaw puzzle and going crazy because I can't find the last piece, and then realizing that Eric's had it stashed in his back pocket. Maybe he's got a reason for not wanting you to finish that puzzle, Ruthann says. I'm not saying what Eric did was right. I'm just saying it might not be wrong either. We drive on in silence to Flagstaff and then veer right onto a different road. I follow Ruthann's directions to a turnoff for Walnut Canyon. We park in a lot next to a ranger's truck, but the gates aren't open yet. Come on, Ruthann says. There's something I want you to see. We have to wait, I point out. But Ruthann just gets out of the car and reaches into the back seat for Sophie. No, we don't, she says. This is where I'm from. We climb over the gates and hike down a trail into a canyon that opens up like a seam between the scarlet rocks. Prickly pear and pinyons grow along the track like markers. The path winds tightly, a sheer 400-foot drop on one side and a wall of rock on the other. Ruthann moves quickly, stepping over the narrowest of passes and crawling around spires and through crevices. The deeper we get, the more remote it seems to be. Do you know where you're going? I ask. Sure. My worst nightmare used to be getting lost in here with a bunch of Pahanas. Turning, she flashes a smile. The Donner Party ate the Indians first, you know. We descend into the canyon, the gap between our path and the facing mass of rock growing narrower and narrower until we have somehow crossed onto the other side. Sophie is the one who spots it first. Ruthann, she says, there's a hole in this mountain. Not a hole, Siwa, she says, a home. As we get closer, I can see it. Carved into the limestone are hundreds of small rooms stacked on top of one another like natural apartment buildings. The walkway spirals around the mountain until we reach the mouth of one of the cliff dwellings. Sophie and Greta, delighted by this carved cave, run from the cedar tree twisted into the mouth of the doorway to the back of the hollowed room. The rear wall is charred. The space smells of brittle heat and fierce wind. Who lived here? I ask. My ancestors, the Hisatsinom. They came here when Sunset Crater erupted in 1065 and covered their pit houses and the farms in the meadows. Sophie chases Greta around a small square of rocks that must have been a fire pit. It's easy to imagine a family huddled around that, telling stories into the night, knowing that dozens of other families were doing the same thing in the small spaces surrounding them. There is a reason the word belonging has a synonym for want at its center. It is the human condition. I turn to her. Why did they leave? No one can stay in one place forever. Even the ones who don't budge, well, the world changes around them. Some people think there might have been a drought here. The Hopi say the Hisatsinom were fulfilling a prophecy to wander for hundreds of years before returning to the spirit world again. Across the way, on the trail we've come in on, the day's first tourists crawl like fire ants. Did you ever think that maybe you've got it upside down? Ruth Ann says. What do you mean? What if the whole kidnapping experience isn't the story of Delia? She asks. What if disappearing wasn't the most cataclysmic event of your life? What else would be? Ruth Ann lifts her face to the sun. Coming back, she says. The Hopi Reservation is a tiny bubble inside the much larger Navajo Reservation, spread across three long-fingered mesas that rise 6,500 feet above sea level. From a distance, they look like the stacked teeth of a giant. Closer, like batter being poured. Almost 12,000 Hopi live in small clusters of villages, and one of those, Sipaulovi, sits on Second Mesa. We park at a landing and hike up a hill over shards of pottery and bones. An old habit, Ruth Ann tells me, from when families would bury food in the ash of their housing foundations to keep from going hungry. We reach a small dusty plaza at the crest of the mesa, a square surrounded by one-story houses. There aren't any adults outside when we arrive, but a trio of little children, not much older than Sophie, dart in and out of the shade between the buildings, appearing and disappearing like ghosts. Two dogs chase each other's tails. On the roof of one building is an eagle, with brightly painted wooden toys and bowls at its feet. Through the windows of the houses, I can hear music, recorded native chants, cartoons, commercial jingles. There is electricity at Sipaulovi, but not at some of the other villages. Ruth Ann says that at old Oraibi, for example, the elders felt that if they took something from the Pahanas would demand something in return. Running water is a new thing, she says, dating back to the 1980s. Before that, you had to carry water in a bucket from a natural spring at the top of the mesa. Sometimes, when it rains, there are still fish in the puddles. Ruth Ann corrals me, slipping her arm through mine. Come on, she says. My sister's waiting. Wilma is the mother of Derek, the boy we watched doing the hoop dance a few weeks earlier. I follow Ruth Ann to one house on the edge of the plaza, a small stone building with one facing window. She opens the door without knocking, releasing the rich smell of stew and cornmeal. Wilma, she says, is that no quivi burning? Wilma is younger than I expected, maybe 5 or 6 years older than me. She's in the process of trying to brush a little girl's hair in spite of the fact that the little girl refuses to sit still. When she sees Ruth Ann, a smile splits her face. What would a skinny old lady like you know about cooking, she says. The house is full of other women, too, wearing a rainbow of colorful housecoats. Many of them look like Wilma and Ruth Ann. Sisters, aunts, I suppose. Hanging on the white walls are carved Katsina dolls, like the ones that Ruth Ann told me about weeks ago. In the corner of the room is a television, crowned by a doily and a vase of tissue paper flowers. You almost missed it, Wilma says, shaking her head. You know me better than that, Ruth Ann answers. I told you I'd be back before the Katsinas left. From here, the conversation slides into the streaming flow of Hopi that I can't follow. I wait for Ruth Ann to introduce me, but she doesn't. And even stranger, no one seems to think this is odd. The little girl who is having her hair brushed is finally freed from her chair and walks up to Sophie. She speaks in perfect English. Want to draw? Sophie slowly peels herself away from me and nods, following the girl into the kitchen, where a cup of broken crayons sits in the center. They begin to draw on brown paper, squares cut from grocery bags. I sit down next to an old woman weaving a flat plate from yucca leaves. When I smile at her, she grunts. The house is the strangest combination of past and present. There are stone bowls with blue corn being hand-ground into meal. There are prayer feathers, like the ones tied to Ruth Ann's Palo Verde tree and the ones left in Walnut Canyon. But there are also linoleum floors, styrofoam cups, and plastic tablecloths. There's a Rubbermaid laundry basket and a teenage girl painting her toenails scarlet. There are two worlds rubbing right up against each other, and not a single person in this room seems to have trouble straddling them. Ruth Ann and Wilma are having an argument. I know this only because of the tone and volume of their words and the way Ruth Ann throws up her hands and backs away from her sister. Suddenly, there is a trilling cry, a low hoot of an owl, something I recognize from walking in the woods in New Hampshire. Immediately, the women begin to whisper and peer out the windows. Wilma says something that I could swear is Hopi for "I told you so." "Come on," Ruth Ann says to me. "I'll show you around." Sophie seems happy coloring, so I follow Ruth Ann outside to the plaza again. "What's going on?" I ask.
"There's a ceremony tomorrow. Niman. It means the home dance. It's the last one before all the Katsinas go back to the spirit world."
I meant with Wilma. I guess I shouldn't have come after all.
"She's not angry because you're here," Ruth Ann says. "It's the owl. No one likes to hear them. It's bad luck."
We have walked down a narrow footpath that leads away from the plaza and are standing in front of a small home made of cinder block. A tongue of smoke licks its way out the chimney. Ruth Ann shields her eyes and stares up at it.
"This is where I used to live when I was married."
I think about my own wedding ceremony, fallen by the wayside in the wake of my father's trial. I wonder if Eric and I will ever get around to that.
"The Hopi way takes years. You do the church thing to get that out of the way, and you find a place to live. But it takes years for your groom's uncles to weave your tuvola, your bridal robes."
Wilma had already had Derek by the time her Hopi wedding came. He was 3 years old and walked with his mother during the ceremony. "What's it like?"
"A lot of work. You have to pay the groom's family back for the robes, with plaques that you weave and food you prepare."
Ruth Ann grins.
"4 days before my wedding, I went to live with my mother-in-law. I fasted, but I had to cook for her and her family. A test, you know, to see if you're worthy of her son, even though I'd been married to him by law for 3 years already. There's a tradition that the groom's paternal aunts come over and throw mud at the groom's maternal aunts while each side complains about the bride and the groom. But it's all a big joke, like those crazy bachelor parties Pahanas have. And then, on the day of, I put on one of the white robes Eldon's uncles had made me. It was beautiful. There were tassels hanging down, each one smaller than the next, like the canes I would use as I got older, getting closer and closer to the earth until my forehead touched it."
"What's the second robe for?"
"You wear it the day you die. You stand on the edge of the Grand Canyon, spread out the robe, step onto it, and rise into the sky as a cloud."
Ruth Ann looks down at her left hand, on which she still wears a gold band.
"You Pahanas have all these rehearsals for your wedding day. To us, the wedding day is the rehearsal for the rest of our lives."
"When did Eldon die?" I ask.
"In the middle of a drought in 1989.
Ruth Ann shakes her head.
"I think the spirits picked him on purpose. Someone larger than life, because they knew he'd be able to bring us rain. On the night he came back, I stood outside this very house, she says. I tilted back my head, and I opened my mouth, and I tried to swallow as much of him as I could. I stare at the smoke curling out of the chimney of the house. Do you know who lives here now? I ask. Not us, she says. And she turns and starts walking slowly up the path. Greta and I sit at the edge of Second Mesa as the sun goes down. Dear Mommy, I write on the back of a grocery bag. Do you know that when you are in elementary school, every teacher celebrates Mother's Day? And because they all felt bad for me, I didn't have to make the bath salt or the woven paper basket or the card. Do you know that the first time I went to buy a bra, I waited in the lingerie department until I saw a woman walk in with a little girl, and I asked her to help me? Do you know that when I was 10, I tried to be Catholic so I could light a candle to you that you'd see from heaven? Do you know that I used to wish I'd die so I could meet you? I glance up, staring at the pancake landscape in the distance. For someone who can't remember very much, there seems to be a lot I can't forget. I know you're sorry, I write. I just don't know if that's good enough. When I put down the pencil, it rolls over the edge of the cliff. Even in this utter quiet, I can hear my mother apologizing for her actions. I can hear my father justifying his. You would think it would be simpler having them both in close proximity, but instead it makes it easier for them to tear me apart. They are both pleading for my vote so loud that I can hardly make up my own mind. Again. I love my father, and I know that he was right to take me. But I am a mother, and I can't imagine having my child stolen away. The problem is that this isn't a case of either or. My mother and father are both right, and at the same time, they were both wrong. When Ruthann walks up behind me, I nearly jump out of my skin. You scared me, I say. She looks tired and lowers herself slowly to the ground. I used to come here a lot, she says, when I needed to think. I draw up my knees. What are you thinking about now? What it feels like to come home, Ruthann says, turning to the San Francisco peaks in the distance. I'm glad you bullied me into bringing you. I grin. Thanks, I think. She shields her eyes against the red glare of the sunset. What are you thinking about? She asks. I stand up and tear the paper into pieces. The same thing, I say, and together we watch the wind take them away. Before dawn the next morning, the plaza is already crowded with people. Some sit on metal folding chairs, others crouch on the roofs of the houses. Ruthann follows Wilma to a spot at the edge of the square, under the overhang of a building. There is no sun yet, but this dance will go on all day, and by then it will be scorching. Sophie is quiet. Perched on my hip, she rubs her eyes. She looks at the golden eagle still tethered to one roof, which beats its wings every few minutes and sometimes cries. When the sun is a fist on the horizon, the Katsinas arrive in a single file up from the kivas, where they have been preparing. They carry armloads of gifts, which they pile in the plaza. Because it didn't rain last night, they have not been allowed to drink this morning, and they will not, no matter how hot it gets. There are almost 50 of them. Hoot Katsinas, I am told, all dressed alike. They wear white skirts and red sashes and loincloths with different patterns. Their arms are decorated with cuffs. Their chests are bare. On their left ankles are bells. On the right, rattles. They hold rattles in their right hands and juniper, womapi, in the left. A necklace with a shell hangs down between each set of shoulder blades. A foxtail swishes between every pair of legs. Their bodies are covered with red ochre paint and a dusting of cornmeal. But the most imposing part of their costumes are the masks. A crown of feathers spiking up from the back of an enormous black wooden head, dog snout, bared teeth, bug eyes. Sophie buries her face in my neck as they begin to chant. The song is deep, guttural, building to a crescendo. The Katsinas turn to the beat of the music in pairs as an old man weaves between them, sprinkling cornmeal and urging them to dance harder. Ruthann pats Sophie on the back. "Shh, Siwa," she says. "They're not here to hurt you. They keep you safe." When they stop dancing an hour or so later, they jangle toward the heaps of gifts they've carried up from the kivas. They toss baked loaves of bread to the people sitting on the roofs. They pass out watermelons and grapes, popcorn balls, peaches. They hand out bowls of fruit, squash, corn, Little Debbie cakes. Wilma, a recent widow, is given one of the biggest baskets. Finally, they pass out presents to the children. For the boys, there are bows and arrows wrapped with cattails and corn stalks. For the girls, Katsina dolls tied with boughs of juniper. One dancer, perspiration pouring down his arms and sides, sweeps across the plaza to the spot where we are sitting. He holds two Katsina dolls, their painted faces glazed by the sun. He hands one to Wilma's daughter and then kneels in front of Sophie. She shrinks away, cowed by the vivid flecks of his mask and the clean, sharp smell of his sweat. He shakes his carved head, and after a moment, her fingers close around the doll. The next morning when I wake up, Ruthann is gone, and Sophie is still fast asleep beside Greta. I tiptoe outside in time to see a man climb to the roof where the golden eagle is tied, watching the ceremonies. The bird beats its wings, but a tether around its foot keeps it from flying away. The man talks softly to the bird as he moves closer, finally wrapping the eagle in a blanket. When a woman comes out of the house beside me, I turn to her, alarmed. "Is he trying to steal the bird?" I ask. "Should we do something?" She shakes her head. "That eagle, Talatawi, he's been watching us since May to see that we've done all the ceremonies well. Now it's time for him to go." She tells me that her son was the one who captured Talatawi, as his father lowered him by rope down a cliff to an eagle's nest. That the eagle's name means song to the rising sun, and that since they've named it, the bird is a member of their family. I wait for her husband to untie the bird, to see it fly off. But as I watch, the man wraps the blanket more tightly around the eagle. He holds it while the bird fights to breathe, and finally it goes limp. He's killing it? The woman wipes her eyes. The eagle, she tells me, is smothered in cornmeal. All of his feathers will be removed, except for a few to be used in pahos and ceremonial objects that will bless the people of Sipaulovi. Talatawi's body will be buried with gifts from the Katsinas and will journey to tell the spirits that the Hopi deserve rain. "It's all for good," she says, her voice shaking. "But that doesn't make it any easier to let go." Suddenly, Wilma slams out of the screen door. "Have you seen her?" she asks. "Who?" "Ruthann. She's gone missing." Knowing Ruthann, she's gone to raid the junk piles that dot the reservation. Yesterday, as we were hiking up toward Sipaulovi, she told me that the Hopi believe when something's wrecked or used up, it has to be given back to the earth, which is why trash is left on the ground and garbage in a heap. Eventually, after you die, you'll get back whatever it is that was broken. At the time, I'd wondered if this held true for hearts. I'm sure she's fine, I tell Wilma. She'll be back before you know it. But Wilma wrings her hands. What if she walked too far and couldn't make it home? I don't know how much strength she's got. Ruth Ann? She could probably win an Ironman competition. But that was before the chemotherapy. The what? Wilma tells me that when Ruth Ann found out, she went to see a native healer, but it had spread too far, too fast, and she turned to traditional medicine. She told Wilma that I've been driving her to the hospital for her appointments, but I have never taken Ruth Ann to any doctor. She has never even mentioned having cancer. On the roof behind us, the man sings a prayer that's striped with grief and rocks the body of Talatawi in his arms like an infant. Wilma, I say, I want you to call the police. I don't want anyone coming with me, namely a tribal police escort, so I surreptitiously sent Greta off a shirt in Ruth Ann's suitcase. The bloodhound immediately begins to strain at her leash, even before I give the command. With Wilma talking to the cops and Derek babysitting for Sophie and his own little sister, Greta and I sneak away unnoticed. We move across yellowed ground split by deep fissures. We step gingerly over slabs of stone that have tumbled from the crests of the mesas. In some places, it is easier than others. In the soft layer of dust that coats the earth, there will be a footprint. Some of the vegetation has been kicked aside or crushed. In other places, the only trace left behind of Ruth Ann is a thread of her scent. There are any number of dangers that might befall Ruth Ann out here. Dehydration, sunstroke, snakes, desperation. It is terrifying to think that her recovery might sit squarely in my hands, and at the same time, there is a part of me that's almost relieved to be doing this sort of work again. If I'm actively looking for someone, it must mean that I'm no longer the one who is lost. Suddenly, Greta stops hard and alerts. She lopes off at a run as I try to dodge boulders and juniper bushes in an effort to keep up. She turns onto a rutted road made for four-wheel drive vehicles and leads me into the bowl of a small canyon. We are ringed by sheer rock walls on three sides. Greta edges closer to the cliffs, pushing her nose along the cracked earth. My boots kick over shards of corrugated pottery and broken arrowheads and owl pellets. On the facings of the rock are markings, spirals, sunbursts, snakes, full moons, concentric circles. I trail my fingers over figures with spears and bighorn sheep, over boys holding what looks like a flower over their heads and girls trying to snatch them away, over twins connected by wavy umbilicus. One entire wall is like a newspaper, hundreds of drawings densely packed into the space. It is amazing how much of the story I can understand, although these must have been hammered into place 1,000 years ago. I am distracted by one symbol, a stick figure that could only be a parent, holding the hand of what could only be a child. Ruth Ann! I call out, and I think I hear an answer. Greta sits at the edge of a narrow crevice, whining as her paws scrabble for purchase. Stay, I command, and I take hold of the edges and hoist myself up to the thin ledge 6 feet off the ground. From here, I can see another foothold. I start to climb. It is when I've worked myself deep into the split of the rock, too far in and too high up to see Greta anymore, that I notice the petroglyph. This artist went to great pains to show this was a woman. She has breasts and loose hair. She is pointed upside down, and her head is separated from her body by a long, wavy line. On the facing rock are a series of notches, precisely cut. I realize it is a calendar meant for a solstice. On a particular day, the sun will hit this just right, and a line of light will slice the neck of the falling woman. A sacrifice. A rain of pebbles from overhead makes me glance up in time to see Ruth Ann step onto the lip of the cliff another 15 feet above me. Her body is wrapped tight in a pure white robe. "Ruth Ann!" I shout, my voice caroming off the rock walls, an obscenity. She looks down at me. Across the distance, our eyes meet. "Ruth Ann, don't," I whisper. But she shakes her head. "I'm sorry." In that half second, I think about Wilma and Derek and me, all the people who do not want to be left behind, who think we know what is best for her. I think about the doctors and the medicines Ruth Ann lied about taking. I think about how I could talk her down from that ledge like I have talked down a dozen potential suicide victims. Yet the right thing to do here is subjective. Ruth Ann's family, who wants her alive, will not be the one to lose hair from drugs, to have surgery to remove her breast, to die by degrees. It is easy to say that Ruth Ann should come down from that cliff, unless you are Ruth Ann. I know better than anyone what it feels like to have someone else make choices for you when you deserve to be making them yourself. I look at Ruth Ann, and very slowly, I nod. She smiles at me, and so I am her witness as she unwraps the wedding robe from her narrow shoulders and holds it across her back like the wide wings of a hawk. As she steps off the edge of the cliff and rises to the spirit world, as the owls bear her body to the broken ground. As soon as I can get a satellite signal, I call the tribal police and tell them where they can find Ruth Ann's body. I let Greta off her leash and toss her the stuffed moose, her reward for making a find. I won't tell anyone what I saw. I won't tell them that I had a chance to stop her. Instead, I will say that this is how Greta and I found Ruth Ann. I will tell the police that I must have been minutes too late. In fact, I got there just in time. I pick up my cell phone again and dial another number. "Please come get me," I say when he answers, and it takes me a while to find the rest of the words I need. Where I am, where he is, how long it will take to reach me. Yesterday morning, before the home dance, when the Golden Eagle was still on the roof waiting for the Katsinas, another eagle arrived. The two birds spent the afternoon in quiet company. Ruth Ann said sometimes that will happen. The eagle's mother visits. And at the end of the day, she flies off, leaving her son behind to do what he has to do. I wonder if the mother eagle will come back to the village now and see that her offspring is missing. I think maybe she won't. I think maybe she knows to look for him in better places. Louise Masawastiwa arrives at Sipalovi that evening. Dressed in a business suit, with her thick black hair chopped into a trendy bob, she could not look more different from her mother if she tried. She's bent over Wilma's kitchen table, her hands wrapped around a mug of tea when I meet her. Her eyes are red. Her features are Ruth Ann's. "You must be the one who found her at Tawaki," she says. I have since learned that Ruth Ann committed suicide at a special site, one with petroglyphs dating back to 750 BC. No one is allowed there without an archaeological permit, and if you walk along the basin opposite the cliffs, you will eventually wind up in Walnut Canyon and the cliff dwellings. "I'm so sorry," I tell Louise. "She never wanted to get treatment. She only said she would because I argued with her about it. I argued with her about everything." Louise reaches for a paper napkin from a holder in the center of the table and wipes her eyes, blows her nose. "They found a lump in her breast 4 months ago. They did surgery that same week. It was a pretty aggressive tumor, but the doctors thought that maybe with some chemo and radiation they'd be able to keep it under control. I probably could have told them right then and there that no one could ever keep my mother under control. I think, I say carefully, that Ruth Ann knew what she wanted. Louise stares down at the checkered plastic tablecloth. A handful of pennies are scattered on the red squares like a makeshift checkerboard. She picks a few up, curls her fist around them. My mother taught me how to count coins, she says quietly. I couldn't get it right for the longest time. I thought a dime was a penny because it was smaller. But my mother wouldn't give up. She told me that if I was going to understand anything in this world, it ought to be change. Louise wipes at her eyes. I'm sorry. It's crazy, isn't it? The way we always say that children belong to their parents, when it's really the other way around. I suddenly remember being very little and being embraced by my father. I would try to put my arms around my father's waist, hug him back. I could never reach the whole way around the equator of his body, although I'd squeeze hard, he was that much larger than life. Then one day, I could do it. I held him instead of him holding me, and all I wanted at that moment was to have it back the other way. Louise opens her hand so that the coins fall like rain. Wouldn't you know it, she says, her mouth curving into a smile. Now I work at a bank. Sophie and I stand on the edge of Second Mesa, underneath the shadow of a circling hawk. What it means, I explain, is that Ruth Ann isn't here anymore. She looks up at me. Is she where Grandpa is? No, Grandpa's going to come back, I say, although I don't know if this is true. When you die, it means you go away forever. I don't want Ruth Ann to go away. Me neither, Soph. Because I need to, I reach down and haul her into my arms. She wraps herself around me, her lips pressed to my ear. Mommy, she says, I want to go wherever you do. Had I said that once to my mother? At the sound of footsteps behind us, I turn around. Fitz walks forward slowly, not sure whether it's all right to interrupt. Thank you for coming, I say, and the words come out too stiff.
I owed you one, Fitz answers.
I look down at the ground. He doesn't ask me what happened. He doesn't ask me why I've called him and not Eric. He knows, without me saying so, that I can't talk about that either yet. I know I told you to go to hell, I say, but I'm glad you ignored me.
Delia, that newspaper story,
you know what, I say, trying to keep my voice from breaking. Right now, I don't need a journalist, but I sure could use a friend. He hunches his shoulders.
I have references.
I offer up the smallest smile, a bridge between us. Actually, I confess, you're the only one who applied. We have just gotten into the car to drive back to Phoenix when the snow begins to fall, a freak act of nature. It starts as a few stray flurries and then sticks to the ground. Dogs leap around, skidding trails with their paws. Children come out of the houses, edging the plaza to catch snowflakes on their tongues. Derek and Wilma, in the middle of the funeral preparations for Ruth Ann, stop what they are doing to look up at the sky. They will tell each other and the people of Sipaulovi that this is proof Ruth Ann has made it to the spirit world. But I think this sign might also be for me. because as Fitz drives away from Second Mesa toward Phoenix, the snow falls harder, blanketing the hood and the windshield and the mesas and the highway until the land is as white as the robe of a Hopi bride, as white as winter mornings in New Hampshire. As a child, I would stand at my window to see the folds of snow draped over my house and Eric's and Fitz's like a sorcerer's scarf. It was easy to pretend that underneath, everything had disappeared. Shrubs and brick paths and soccer balls, hedges and fences and property lines. It was easy to pretend that when the magician pulled away his handkerchief, the world would start over from scratch. I don't think Fitz is at all surprised when I ask him to make a detour on our way home. He waits in the parking lot with Sophie and Greta, who are asleep in the back seat of the car. "Take your time," he says, as I walk into the jail. There is only one other inmate with a visitor. My father sits down on the other side of that wall of plexiglass and picks up the phone.
"Is everything all right?"
I look at him in his stripes, with a bandage wrapped around his left hand and a healing cut on his temple, with a nervous tremor that makes him keep glancing to the side to see if someone is coming up behind him, and I cannot believe that he is asking me that question. "Oh, Daddy," I say, all the tears coming at once. He balls his hand into a fist and then from the core of it pulls a plume of a Kleenex. Sleight of hand. But then he remembers that he can't get the tissue to me through the barrier of the wall or over the telephone connection. He smiles faintly.
"Guess I haven't learned that trick yet."
When we did our magic show for the seniors, my father had had to convince me to do the vanishing act. He explained the reality to me. Out of sight is out of mind. But I still believed that once the black curtain came down, I'd be gone for good. I was so nervous that he cut the tiniest of holes in the curtain for me. If I could keep an eye on him, he said, then surely I wouldn't really disappear. I had forgotten about that hole until just now. It makes me wonder if I had remembered, even unconsciously, the way we had run away from home. If even at 6 years old, I had to learn to trust him to bring me back. Maybe if it hadn't been such an awful day, I would have noticed that on the ride home from the jail, Fitz had gotten quieter and quieter. But I've been thinking of Ruth Ann and my father. It isn't until we pull up to the trailer and I see Eric's car outside that I panic. 2 days ago, which feels more like 200, I had left him behind in the hospital, angry at him for doing the job I had asked him to do. "Come in," I beg Fitz, turning to him like I always do for support. "Be a buffer."
"I can't."
"Pretty please," I say. I glance into the back seat, where Sophie is still snoring in little puffs beside the dog. "You can carry her in." Fitz looks at me, his face expressionless.
"No, I'm busy."
"Doing what?" When he rounds on me, angry, it is so unlike the Fitz I know that I find myself shrinking back against the passenger seat.
"For God's sake, Delia, I just drove 600 miles for you and you weren't even technically speaking to me."
Heat rises to my cheeks. "I'm sorry. I thought..."
"What, that I have nothing better to do? That I don't have a life? That I might not spend all that time with you wishing I was doing this?"
His hands lock on each side of my face, and he pulls me forward like gravity. When his mouth seals over mine, it is brutal, bitter. The stubble of beard on his face leaves a mark on my skin, raw and shaped like regret. He isn't Eric, and so our lips don't move in a familiar rhythm. He isn't Eric, and so our teeth grit against each other. He holds the back of my head as if he is afraid I will break away. My heart beats so hard I begin to feel it in forgotten places, behind my eyes, at the base of my throat, between my legs. "Mommy?" Fitz immediately releases me, and we both turn around to see Sophie watching us curiously from her car seat. "Oh, Jesus," he murmurs.
"Sophie, honey," I say quickly, "you're having a dream." I fumble for the door latch and step out of the car, then reach into the back and haul my daughter into my arms.
"Isn't it funny, the things we think we see when we're sleeping?"
She sinks into my shoulder, boneless, as Greta bounds out of the car. By now, Fitz is standing outside, too.
"Delia."
A light goes on in the trailer, and the door opens. Eric, bare-chested and wearing boxers, comes down the aluminum stairs. He takes Sophie out of my arms, a transaction of commerce. Before we can say anything to each other, the sound of Fitz's car engine slices the night in half. He peels away, leaving a cloud of dust and grit in his wake.
"Ruth Ann's sister called to see if you got home," Eric says quietly so that he doesn't wake Sophie. "She told me what happened."
I follow him up the steps, wait to answer until he has laid Sophie down in our bed and pulled up the cover.